Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show alive and kicking at newstalk.com, or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, I'll be talking to Emma Slade, the first Westerner to become a Buddhist nun in Bhutan and a key figure in the Gross National Happiness Project. How much of a challenge is it for people across the country to have access to a GP they trust, particularly when it comes to female health? And Áine Ní Breslán on her TG Cathair series Sonus, exploring wellness across Ireland, mind, body and soul. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, all is good. Nothing like a good bank holiday to set you right. And it's perhaps our most nostalgic, patriotic one. So still seem to be continuing those Patrick's Day vibes this week. And I've been getting lots of emails from so many of you about neurodivergence in school, as over the weeks I alluded to some of the stresses of my son starting secondary school. So I feel it's only right that I update you with the positive news that things have settled down a lot. I had a very good meeting with the school. I felt I got to represent my son and hear from them. And between that and a parent-teacher meeting where I also met a lot of positive people doing their best, I have to say I feel more comfortable with it all, as does he. Now, that's not to say the challenges are over. He is still very much a square peg in a round hole, but it's not all bad. And I think it's important to say that and to highlight that there are many people doing the best they can with the resources that they have. I've also been resourcing myself and trying to learn as much as I can, as well as figuring out what suits us and him best. So if you are going through a tough time, I just wanted to let you know that things can improve. I also have a friend that I want to mention whose son is 5, a gorgeous little guy who has autism. And with the support of his parents and his sister and the Montessori he went to and the special school placement that he's had for the last 2 years, he has come such a long way and has even begun to speak more words than ever before in the last few months. They have all found a way to communicate over the years, but he's really been thriving and advancing, which is what you want for any child. But as of now, he doesn't have a school place for September. Along with many other special needs children, there's simply not a place for them at all, meaning they won't get the support they need, the education they deserve, the socialisation that is essential for all human beings. And the knock-on effects for so many families is, for many, they won't be able to continue working, as someone will need to be at home for their child. And it doesn't make any sense to me why in 2025 we are allowing this to be a reality. I know a group of parents staged a protest in Dublin city centre and a sleep out, and they are all now contacting their local TDs as well as writing to many schools and getting letter after letter of refusal. This stress is so unnecessary. So it puts my experience into perspective. But now that we have so much more awareness of neurodivergence, why are we still failing to give these kids the support that they deserve? I always stand by the statement that a society is judged on how they treat their most vulnerable. If you have experience of this, you can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, something else I asked you about recently and got lots of emails about was access to GPs. Of course, GPs are doing their best up and down the country, but a number of you got in contact to say finding a female GP or someone who is an expert in female health can be a challenge. Dr. Siobhan Chidley runs Watermills Family Practice in Kildare and she joins me in studio now. Siobhan, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
Now, not that we're going to ask you to solve all of this, you're one GP, but have you felt this also? Have you heard this from people coming to your clinic?
Yes, it's throughout. It's been for a good while. I think general practice is trying to catch up, and they have. I mean, we'd be a training practice, so they've doubled the number of GPs in training at the moment. They've doubled their number of spaces. So coming into GP training this year, there's double the number of GPs than there were last year. And interestingly, there were 1,200 people who applied for general practice last year for the 350 places. This year, there were 1,800 people who applied for the 350 places. So it's definitely, it's something that the College of GPs has been working on. But unfortunately, I suppose, like building houses, it takes a while to train a GP. And then not only to train them is to retain them. That's where the problem comes, is it's retaining them. And it's a complicated process, like building a house. But it is being worked on, I think.
And all of those things play a role, don't they? Because we do often hear of the brain drain, that we may have somebody train, but then the cost of living here, the difficulty in finding a house can often mean that they take that expertise to live elsewhere.
Definitely. They definitely live elsewhere. But it's I suppose the attraction of Ireland is family and people and the community. So people inherently, and especially the doctors, they want to stay here. But the problem with staying here, not only it's where to live and how to do it, it's the circumstances that a person might find themselves in working as a doctor in Ireland. And when you compare that, I believe, to places like Canada and Australia, where I haven't worked, but it is different. And the expectation that's put onto the doctor is different. And the lifestyle and the work-life balance that the doctor themselves can get is probably easier to achieve in different countries. And I don't think that's particularly addressed here at the moment.
I'm going to ask you a little bit about that in a moment, but the journal Investigates released some figures about GPs, and a surge in population hasn't quite been matched by this increase in GPs. As you say, it's going to take time, but we have an increasing population, we have an ageing population, so there is a lot of pressure on current GPs.
The pressure's huge. The pressure's huge because the general practice itself has changed massively, and I don't think the general person would be aware of how general practice has changed. When I started, general practice was a place that you popped in for with your sore throat, and if you had anything sort of really significant, you were referred to secondary care. Now general practice is taking over an enormous amount of secondary care. They're integrated in primary care teams into the secondary care unit. The depth and the detail that the GP is expected to know now, and the amount of care that the GP is providing now is way, way, way in excess of what it used to be. It's, you know, so each consultation, especially as a female GP, you find each consultation is 20 minutes, half an hour. If you have to do the detailed job, it's not the 10 minutes, 15 minutes. So you can't see as many people as you could during the day. And then the other thing that has come is a deluge of admin. It's a deluge of paperwork, form filling, which takes hugely valuable time for someone. Really, do you need to be a GP to do that type of admin? No. So it's about trying to expand the GP team, you know, but then there's sort of issues around contracts and provision of service that go with that. General practice is a massively changing, very exciting, actually, area at the moment. But it's people have to change their view of general practice, I think. And then the extra services that are involved in general practice need to take off. And then it'll come back. Because basically you need GPs doing what GPs do. And the extra bits need to be done by someone else. But now what's happening is we're doing an awful lot of a load of extra bits that's taking away for our primary role as a GP.
And are people coming now more informed and more armed? I think it's been a positive thing in many ways. Yeah. But what they say years ago, the doctor and the priest held all the power in each community. Whereas now people are finding out information all over the place, from the internet to Dr. Google. So they're coming expecting more. And in many ways, that's a good thing that people are more informed, but that only ramps up the pressure.
Well, it ramps up the pressure, but I think it's fantastic. I like that. You know, it gives a vibrant consultation. It gives a discussion around what a person wants, so that the person is getting what they want out of their healthcare journey. But on the other hand, it's not to trivialize healthcare, but like if you were going to go and get a new kitchen, you Google it, you look at it, and you have your pictures, and you go with a picture of your kitchen. And then you don't go into the kitchen maker and say, do you mind doing the bedroom cupboards as well while you're here? So it's about being realistic with the expectation that the person coming to the doctor is coming with. So if you've gone and you've Googled that your rash is due to to a reaction to your milk? And the doctor says to you, well, no, actually, it's probably not. It's maybe an issue with your platelets. We need to look at that. It's to be able to work in collaboration with the doctor, because you're coming to get the advice that you're seeking. You're not coming to with your shopping list with a list of orders. It's not the same as going to Tesco's, where you say, well, I want that, and then come out with that. And I think that's a lot of where GPs take up a lot of time. So if somebody would come in and say, I've got a chest infection, I need an antibiotic, it could you take you 15 minutes to explain to somebody, but this isn't bacterial, this is viral, this is the other. And then you have to go into lifestyle, then you have to go into stress, then you have to go into sleep. And all of those things take a lot of time, where previously it was, well, you have a chest infection, there's your amoxicillin and go home and that's it. It's exciting. I think if the fact that people know more, you can have more of a discussion, and you can give people homework. And I think that's also what's a little bit missing. People think that healthcare is going to be provided to them, and it's not. It's actually provided with them. So it's to give advice, to go and look at it, to do bits, to come back, to work with it. And it's a collaborative process, very much like building a kitchen, back and forth and back and forth. It's not a beginning point and an end point. And I think people, especially people when they have to pay for it, they look at it and they come in and they say, look, I want, quote, bang for my buck. And they have 9 deep issues that they need to discuss. And it's physically not possible to get through that in 15 minutes. But, you know, again, it's the way, and it's how you present to your doctor. It's the type of discussion you have with the doctor. And I think it's not so much the doctor per se. It's the practice. Because I know in our practice, the most important person is definitely the admin staff, and they know exactly with your, if you had a little discussion with them about what was wrong, they know which doctor to put you in with, because each doctor has their strengths, each doctor has their weaknesses. And, you know, just because I'm female doesn't necessarily make my strength women's health. I mean, and on our menopause group, on our fertility group, on our termination of pregnancy group, the lead man actually is a man, and he's amazing. And he has every single knowledge about menopause, termination of pregnancy, fertility, and he would be my go-to. So the gender, I don't think, is as important as the human and the person that you're seeing. And it, within a practice, if you see this doctor because you have diabetes and he and or she is very good at diabetes, marvelous. As it happens, you might be diabetic and have a menopause issue where Dr. B may be better at dealing with menopause. So then the receptionist would put you in with Dr. B, who's better at dealing with menopause, although you generally see Dr. A with your diabetes. And I think if people understood that, it would take the pressure off GP practice a bit.
Yeah, and when I threw this out online and on the show, the deluge of contact that I got was around this feeling comfortable and confident in their practice. And I heard from women who would show up with symptoms and be told it's not perimenopause, it's too early, or people just feeling dismissed. And I think it's easy for me to sort of say, get out there, find someone you can trust. But people were kind of replying saying, there isn't anybody else. I have tried. What's your advice there?
Yeah, that's unfortunate to hear that people are feeling that, because that's not what we as GPs want to hear. It's very sad that I think it is out there. And I suppose I work in general practice, and then obviously naturally as being in general practice, you work in out of hours. So you get, when you're in out of hours, you see that from people. They say, oh, I can't get an appointment for my GP for the next 3 weeks. And, you know, my answer would be, well, did you take that appointment? Oh, no, I didn't. So it's about planning. So if you need to see your GP and you've got a significant issue like menopause, like, you know, that's slightly complicated, maybe mental health issues, obesity, lifestyle related issues, those issues, number one, take a little while. And number two, they can be planned. It's not like the sore throat or the vomiting bug that has to be seen on the day. So If there's 3 weeks to see your GP, well, yes, make that appointment. Tell receptionist that this is going to be a menopause consultation. Therefore, the receptionist will allocate the GP more time. And that way they won't be dismissed. What happens often with people is the dismissed, and I see it a lot with me being a female GP in quite a male-dominated practice, is that the person will come in and they will have told the receptionist that they have a chest infection, so that they're squashed in on the day because we'd see chest infections as very important. So we'll put the person in for that consultation for the chest infection, and you'll do the chest infection, and you're 10 minutes into the consultation. And while you're at it, doctor, would you mind, please, I've actually got a little rash. And you say, well, fair enough. Let me look at that, because a rash, you never know what that could be. Let me try that. And actually, you know, while I'm here, do you mind? I've got a few sweats, and I'm just thinking, do I have symptoms of menopause? Menopause, by definition, takes half an hour, 20 minutes to discuss at a minimum. So, you know, after you've done, you're already running late, you were booked in for a chest infection, you've come in with a chest infection and a rash, and now you want to add in menopause. That's often where the dismissed comes in. It's planning. And I think if people had an understanding of how general practice works, and maybe there's a bit more education out there of how to plan your appointment, how to plan what you're doing. Because we often get people saying to the receptionist, well, it's not your business what's wrong with me. Well, it isn't, but she's not trying to be nosy. She's trying to get you the right practitioner for the right amount of time at the right time, so that you get the best care that you can.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And, it doesn't mean to put it back on the patient with blame, but this information is quite empowering. And I think even if you do get dismissed the first time, you advocate for yourself, you start to keep a journal of your symptoms, and you book in for a longer appointment, and you bring that and you say, no, you said it isn't perimenopause, but this is what I've experienced over the last month, and I want to talk to you about it again. We don't have to kind of slope off and lick our wounds, as it were, although I kind of have been that person. So I'm saying that with absolute empathy.
I think that's exactly the point. It's to say, my favorite consultations, when a patient comes in with a list, and it doesn't bother me at all, it's the list. And I get the list, and I can go through the list, and I can say, well, look, I can do this and I can do this. These three link, I can deal with that today. With regard to this and this, I hear you. I know that that's a problem. It's not as much of an emergency today. Would you mind if I book you in next week? And let's talk about that then.
Yeah.
Then you've got the consult. And always at the end of it, I think most GPs would say, have I dealt with what you needed to deal with today? And that's a nice way to end it. You know, have I done what you needed me to do today? And then somebody might say, no, you didn't deal with my menopause. And you say, but you did come in with your chest infection. So can we book you in for the menopause consultation next week?
Yeah. And I think people obviously think about the cost involved in that they're paying for this and they're paying for next week. And I know there are lots of people struggling to make ends meet. And I completely understand that. But it's an investment, isn't it, in your health? And something else that you really focus on is around lifestyle and preventative medicine. So I did notice, having a look on your website ahead of today, you offer half an hour appointments for people to come in and look at their lifestyle. So yes, that's very different to arriving sick and needing an antibiotic or a prescription or needing secondary care. This is very different. This is an ongoing relationship. And I hope that practices across the country will start to move to that.
Well, I think they will. I mean, the general practice is a lot about lifestyle, and we're taking on a lot of chronic disease. And chronic disease doesn't get better or managed better without changes in lifestyle. But changes in lifestyle are slow. They're incremental. It is back and forward. It's tweaking. It's adding little bits, little bits, little bits. And that's the only way one's going to have ongoing health. And it's like an orchestra. It's an interrelationship between healthcare, lifestyle, mental well-being, you know, relationships. And it's all the different practitioners coming together. And the GP is just one little part of the orchestra. It is not the entire orchestra. And I think the expectation on general practice these days is that it's the GP is all everything. And that's terrible pressure to put on a cohort of people, because we were just one cog in healthcare. We're one cog in wellness. We're one cog in well-being. And I think if patients understood that, and they realized that we're just one cog, And we can push you in the directions of the correct cog, and people have to, they have to put in the effort. And it, and unfortunately, because we don't have, you know, one healthcare system, there are costs involved. And while we'd love it not to be, and we'd love a wonderful magic one, but there isn't. You know, so just like you would pay to get your lawyer to do something, or you'd pay to get your kitchen maker to do it, or you get your hair done, or you do Botox, or you do fillers. People do pay for these things, and it's about, you know, making, putting your resources where you want them to be. Is it in the chipper and with two or three pints on a Friday night, or is it the extra bit on your lifestyle, the extra appointment with the doctor? You don't know where people's money is coming from. And I think my experience of general practice is that we know our patients, and we know where people are really, really struggling. And I work with a lot of GPs, and we all do the same. We know when people are really, really struggling, and we don't chase people for money. We don't insist on it. We're not built that way when we know. But unfortunately, as a baseline, there is a cost, and one has to do that.
Well, it sounds like Kildare are lucky to have you. If you want to find out more about Siobhan's work, you can go to watermills.ie. Dr. Siobhan Chidley, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Áine Ní Breslin is a radio and TV presenter from Gweedore in County Donegal. Her latest endeavour, Sunnis on TG Cahir, sees her try the latest therapies and treatments and meet people who have changed their lives in the pursuit of wellness. And Áine joins me on the line now. Áine, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be on.
And what made you want to make this series?
I suppose I wanted to make this series to track my own life journey, maybe changing from being in full-time employment for the first time in 18 years, leaving that and going more freelance and trying new projects, be it with television and radio and so on. And I wanted to talk to people who maybe had tried their own journeys and had maybe gone towards wellness for more of a life, work-life balance, and to see how those therapies might have helped them or how they could benefit me as well, trying to have more quality of life and a better quality of life.
And it's interesting, isn't it? I know from this job myself, when you meet people who work in the wellness industry, almost 90% of them reached some sort of burnout or low in life that made them think, nah, going to do this differently, and leaned in.
Absolutely. And I suppose a lot of people, whether they practice wellness as their primary job now, or whether they just tap into some of it as a maybe something that sustains them in their different careers, they all reached a point where they said, I want to have more quality of life, more balance, more time to myself, or more time with my friends and my family. And I want to take better care of myself. And I suppose a lot of jobs now, that you don't switch off at 5 o'clock. If you turn off your computer, a lot of people have their work as part of their lives. They're working from home. They find it very hard to achieve maybe a space where they can give themselves the time to take care of themselves. So I wanted to see what people had tried and what had drawn them towards making that decision of going in a different direction or looking for something a bit deeper to help them on their way.
And before filming this series, what role did health and wellness play in your life?
I had what I suppose I would call a passing interest in certain wellness things. I was interested in a very basic level, I suppose, in things like aromatherapy, reflexology. I had tried a little bit of yoga. I wasn't an active gym goer. I enjoyed being outdoors and being in nature, but I wasn't practicing anything consistently or specifically, but I was definitely very open and very interested in trying different things. I knew that I was kind of quite open-minded anyway and would be interested in reading about a lot of therapies. But when it came to doing them, then I said, okay, I'll be open to try them. But I didn't have any structured regimes really in place at all.
So how did you choose which practices to try and feature in the series?
Well, I was in a discussion role, I suppose, before we started shooting with producers. I was literally just after leaving my job with RTE when we began filming. So they kind of made that a part of the journey, and that I was trying to open myself up to trying new things work-wise and then wellness-wise. I told them some of the areas I was broadly interested in. I was interested in looking at stuff like acupuncture, stuff to do with crystals and things like that. I was interested in things that had nature strongly in the practice, be that plant medicine or anything like that. But some of them were therapies they had discovered, and obviously all of the practitioners had Irish, and it was actually amazing. There were so many people with Irish practicing in all different parts of the wellness industry, but some of it was my decision and some of it was up to the producers to see what would make good television as well.
So what sticks out in your mind from the series?
In terms of some of the therapies I tried that really stayed with me, we did forest bathing in a beautiful native Irish woodland near Ballybeg House in the Wicklow Mountains, and we did that with a mental health nurse, and she speaks about the benefits of nature, of being in nature, the stillness to help people's moods. And we also did that with a man who's training to be a shaman. So he has spent a lot of time learning about the benefits of plants, trees, nature, the life around us. That really stuck with me. We did it with a group of older people who do it on a monthly basis, and they get great benefit from going into the woods, sitting there, being in the stillness and the calmness of nature. And they were also attuned to it because they're not probably as stuck on their phones as you know, younger generations. That was really beautiful because it's something anyone can do, and it's accessible to a lot of people, and you can also do it anywhere there's a parkland or a woodland. I loved that. We did a lot of work on breath work. I went to a breath work and yoga workshop in Ashir on the Aran Islands, and did that. There was a lot of yoga and breath work by the beach, sitting by the sea. I think the setting really helped us, and it was following the path of an ancient Irish pilgrimage to do with St. Gobnet. So there was a connection with the older practices and then maybe the newer side of wellness. I thought that was very special. A lot of these practices have been around for hundreds of years. It's just they're maybe becoming more in fashion, or people are becoming more aware of them.
Yeah, you certainly see wellness practices have gone from being niche to being popular and more commonplace, and the speed I'm noticing at which things go from being a trend that might come in from something that's big in Bali or, you know, certain parts of America, all of a sudden becomes more mainstream. Saunas alone are popping up beside coastlines all over the country, and it is really lovely to see. What about your sacred sexuality and chanting workshop? Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, so we were down in rural Tipperary in a place called Upper Church, and there is a musician and singer there, and she has practiced the sacred sexuality, divine feminine workshops for many years. Her name is Ketch Nurian, and she worked with myself and a group of women. She does women-only courses. A lot of them are just for women. And we worked on finding our voice through chanting, through song, to help release tensions, help find your sort of your inner power and your autonomy, and did all that outside. There was a lot of work on grounding and lying in the grass and connecting with the earth, trying to find the different sort of parts of your body through the chants that would go deeper and higher through the torso, through the body. And it was a beautiful space. There was a kind of, we held space for each other. We spoke about femininity, about being a woman in Ireland, about everything it means, the history, and a lot of, I suppose, the burdens and the difficulties that were placed upon women in Ireland as well as in other societies. And at the end of the day, we had myself and Ketch went to a river that was nearby, and we swam under a waterfall as a kind of a cleansing experience at the end. I'm very interested in traditional Irish song and folklore, and a lot of that was part of the workshop. It was very powerful, and you know, at times you'd forget that there were cameras there, because I had to just say to myself, I have to just be present in this moment and just let the cameras figure out what they're going to be shooting around it. But it was a very powerful experience. I really, really enjoyed it.
And so interesting that it's come to you, not only from a career perspective, at a time where you wanted to jump and try new things, and this became one of those things, but to help you navigate that leap, you had these deeper wellness practices. What impact has it had on you personally?
Well, as I said, I wasn't someone who was probably very structured or very consistent in any practices I had. And, you know, I traveled an awful lot for work. I might have been working on a few different projects at once. And, you know, there's a lot of pressure and stress in media. As part of the wellness journey, we looked at more conventional things such as having a healthy attitude towards sport or working out. So I worked with a personal trainer, and I'm still working with her a year later in terms of actually going to the gym and having a routine. That helped me just in terms of even something so simple as getting outside, getting walking, getting my steps done, doing my workout, staying consistent for myself. In terms of some of the other practices, anything that involved being in nature, like the forest bathing, I was sort of doing that unbeknownst to myself, but trying to be more conscious when I'm doing it, as in not just having the headphones blaring when I'm walking. You know, I live here beside the sea in Donegal. Other people would come and they would sit and listen to the sea for hours, and I'd be just walking past it, not taking it in, to be more conscious in those practices. The acupuncture I really enjoyed. I hadn't tried it before, and I was interested in just seeing how it would impact me or how it would affect me, and I thought that was lovely. But one of the most maybe things that stayed with me most was we did a few practices that were based in groups, and it was about the happiness factor that comes with being in a social setting, making friendships, kind of the good endorphins that come from a communal experience. So we did a thing called the Cozy Club, where women get together, get to know each other, maybe do something like they might paint or they might craft, do a little something like that. And then you can build friendships and just build a connection and a network. So a lot of wellness practices, they may focus on the person as themselves, but there's often a connection to the wider network that we're all, I suppose, craving and looking for, that can only help boost your happiness as well.
Love it. Sounds like you've ticked all the boxes that make up health and well-being. I am very excited to see what you do next. The series is called Sunnis. It's on Wednesdays at 8:30 on TG Cahir. Áine Ní Breslán, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, International Day of Happiness took place this week, and I feel I have the perfect guest for us on this topic. She is speaking this weekend at Weekend of Mistakes. It returns to Hay Castle in the UK with an incredible lineup of writers, thinkers and podcasters to explore not only history's greatest missteps, but explore one of the most pressing questions of our time. How can we be happier? Well, Emma Slade is the first Westerner to become a Buddhist nun in Bhutan and is a key figure in the Gross National Happiness Project, a leading advocate for integrating well-being and happiness into economic policy. She joins me on the line now. Emma, you're very welcome.
Oh, thank you very much.
So, Emma, people might be thinking economics and happiness, how do they mix? But your life literally has been that. You started out in finance.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, I was a senior financial analyst, mainly based in Hong Kong.
And what brought about change in your career?
Oh, so I had a kind of extraordinary situation of being held hostage at gunpoint in Jakarta on a business trip, actually. And obviously that was a huge experience and made me reevaluate really what I wanted to do with my life. And much as I absolutely adored analyzing economics and markets, and it's a very kind of exciting world to be in, I felt that I'd probably move to a place after that incident where I wanted to do something perhaps more deeper, more meaningful, and something kind of more peaceful as well.
Is that when Buddhism and yoga came into your life?
Yes, although I'd always been interested in Buddhism. I think the, you know, if you see a statue of the Buddha meditating, I think many people can feel, oh, that looks interesting, it looks peaceful, and I, you know, I wonder what he's doing in a way. And I think even in the 70s, I'd seen some books and statues of Buddhas, and I'd always been intrigued as to the state of mind of a Buddha.
And I think we all sort of have that in our minds, that to live like a Buddhist monk is to live a very peaceful life. But most people think that's not accessible to them. But you made the journey to Bhutan. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Yes. And I think that actually, you know, being a Buddhist monk, female monk, is just a really wonderful thing. It's not without its challenges, but it's definitely the right path for me. It's not the right path for everybody. in terms of becoming a peaceful human being who makes a contribution in this world. I think you can do that from many walks of life, but you need the intention to do it. You need the wish to do it and then know how to put it into action. It's just lucky as a monk because a lot of your time is spent looking at that intention and then trying to act well and authentically, you know, with whatever you do. And obviously, as a monk, we get less involved in daily worldly activities, which take up a lot of people's time, can often cause a lot of anxiety and a lot of confusion for people. So we're lucky that we're not so involved in that area. So that is really a gift. But I do believe that it's the possibility of every human to find their own way to be peaceful and to feel meaningful in this world.
So what are some of the principles of Buddhism that everybody could bring into everyday life?
Well, from a Buddhist point of view, in terms of being peaceful or a state of contentment, we would suggest that people need to think very carefully about what that means for them in terms of their material possessions, in terms of what they do in this world. So usually we get very caught up in the idea that more is better. And then we strive a lot to get more of stuff. And actually it seems, even from an economic point of view, we know there's the law of diminishing returns. So actually it's not true that the more you have, the happier you are. We can see that actually that doesn't happen. But somehow we still feel as if more is better, right? So I think looking at that idea and working out, okay, where does contentment lie for me? Where do I go, okay, this is enough for me now. Because saying this is enough now, I have what I need, is very empowering, and it tends to bring a very peaceful state of mind because you're not grasping for more. So that inquiry, that personal inquiry for everybody, I think is really worth doing. Then I think looking at the balance between stimulating activities in your life, which tend to trigger our anxiety system, tend to trigger our flight and fight response, and times when we're valuing, times when we are relaxing and giving back to ourselves, and in what we would call the parasympathetic nervous system, the part of the nervous system which gives us that good feedback and we feel relaxed and we feel positive about ourselves. So I think it's very easy to get caught up in the sympathetic nervous system, and from that system we achieve a lot, but we also become very anxious. And often people feel time when they're not achieving is like wasted time. It's not particularly productive. They've got nothing to show for it. But for your being, your whole being and your inner landscape, times when you're letting yourself relax and feel connected to others, feel peaceful, breathe well, they're very important for our well-being, to be honest.
So can you take us back to that Emma who was at the top of her game in the financial world? You had that major life event, that traumatic event. How did you becoming a female Buddhist monk come about?
Well, I guess I did. First of all, I had to recover from a very traumatic event. And that I did a lot of, I had the opportunity to work with people who've been taken hostage. And that was very helpful in terms of integrating that experience. Because when you've had trauma, you don't really want to integrate it. You want to push it away. And that creates a lot of problems for the mind. So first of all, I had to recover from the trauma. But in the process of recovery, I still felt as if my body had a lot of the memories of the trauma in it. So kind of mentally I'd come to terms with it, but my body still, and my breathing system, it was still quite anxious, and I used to sort of jump out of my skin when people came up behind me, etc. So that was really the thing that made me think breathing and yoga. I need to do something with my body about this trauma. So, you know, I did a lot of yoga and became actually a yoga teacher, and that naturally led into looking at meditation, because meditation is actually part of yoga. And from there, the sort of interest in Buddhism became rekindled. And Buddhist practice really, I would say, specializes in meditation. When we look at the Buddha, we see him sitting down in a meditation posture. So I yeah, and that's how I ended up going to Bhutan, which is this Buddhist country, and where there's many, many meditators, specialist meditators, and I just have had the opportunity to learn from some of those now and, you know, take steps towards understanding meditation and its benefits. But I do say that meditation is not necessarily the only way for people to connect with their own well-being and find ways to peacefulness. So it's one option, but it's not the only one. So sometimes people feel meditation is not for them, but that just means there are other methods that help people feel more content, feel more peaceful, and feel they make a contribution in this world.
And then, as I mentioned, in 2022, you became the first and only Western woman to ever be fully ordained in the Himalayas itself, which was historic in Bhutan. 142 yeah. nuns were given That's right. full ordination on a level equivalent to monks. So even though we've spoken about that idea of enough and not being so caught up in achievement, did you still allow yourself to feel the weight of that historic moment?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to stress that this was something that happened in Bhutan, and it's a huge step forward for, you know, the possibility for females within Buddhism. And so, as you say, we got the vows to place us on an equivalent with monks. And that is still quite rare in some Buddhist countries. And that may surprise people. So first of all, I want to say that Bhutan was amazing for doing that. And I was absolutely honored to be part of it. And it was an incredible event in the mountains of Bhutan, in the forests of Bhutan, with many flags and music and tapestries, and it was just the most incredible event to be part of. I think I just spent a lot of time pinching myself that I was there, because, you know, I'm born in England by the sea, and somehow I've ended up in the mountains of Bhutan with other nuns from Bhutan and Sikkim and Ladakh. And nobody looks like me, to be frank. You know, on a very basic level, nobody looks like me. And I'm having to take vows in the Tibetan language. And so I was mainly just like, how did I get here? How was this even possible in the span of a life, you know? Or, you know, if you think back of my days in Hong Kong in suits and heels, I mean, how did I end up here? You know, so I think it was mainly that I just couldn't believe it was happening. And I just felt really proud of Bhutan for taking this very brave step to do this for women. I just felt really proud of them.
And I know you have such a connection to Bhutan. You have your charity Opening Your Heart to Bhutan to help special needs children there. But I couldn't have you on without asking you about happiness. It's the topic of your speaking event at the weekend. What is your take on happiness?
So, you know, as a monk, it's a big question, right? Because mainly from our perspective, when people talk about happiness, and there's many books out there about it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, mainly people are talking about worldly happiness. You know, we're happy one moment, then we lose it the next. So most of the models of worldly happiness, whether we look at the happiness index in Bhutan or we look at the happiness index in Scandinavia, which is very interesting, they're trying to create a society conditions which make it more likely for a population to more consistently experience happiness. Things like good governance, social welfare, clean environment. So they're outer conditions. From a Buddhist monastic point of view, we really train that stable happiness comes from how we view reality. So that's where we do our meditation practice into the nature of reality. From a Buddhist meditation point of view, from a philosophical point of view, a lot of our unhappiness comes not from what's going on, but from how we see and how we perceive and we understand what's going on. It's all about your mind and how easily your mind is disturbed by things going on around you. And that's why we train our minds in meditation.
Well, I think you will have given people a lot of insight and also a lot of inspiration that life can change in ways that we never, never expect them. If you'd like to find out more about Emma and her work, you can go to emmaslade.com. Emma, it's been such a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So that is it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Marisa O'Sullivan. Rory Galvin was on podcasts and Hugo Da Silva Scott was on sound. And thanks as ever to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.